changed, had he not?
Pelligerokin had always been a violent boy. And Bella Panken was a most peculiar woman, living out on that farm with her strange son, Yuri. A Kitka could take any form. Perhaps she had not found that missing girl's doll at all. Standing at the lip of her mother's grave, Nadia noted Anton's seeping stump and lewd grin. Wiry Pelligerokin with his tangled hair and bald fists. Bella Panken's worried frown, and the sympathetic smile of the widow, Karina Stoyanova. The way her lovely black eyes stayed on Nadia's father as the coffin he'd carved with such care was lowered into the hard ground. The Kitka might take any form, but the shape it favored most was that of a beautiful woman. Soon, Karina seemed to be everywhere, bringing Nadia's father food and gifts of kvass, whispering in his ear that someone was needed to take care of him and his children. Havel would be gone for the draft soon, off to train in Politsnaya and begin his military service, but Nadia would still need minding.
After all, said Karina in her warm, honey voice, you do not want her to disgrace you.
Later that same night, Nadia went to her father as he sat drinking kvass by the fire. Maxim was whittling. When he had nothing to do, he sometimes made dolls for Nadia, though she'd long since outgrown them. His sharp knife moved in restless sweeps, leaving curls of soft wood on the floor. He'd been too long at home. The summer and fall that he might have spent seeking out work had been lost to his wife's illness, and the winter snows would soon close the roads. As his family went hungry, his wooden dolls gathered on the mantel, like a silent, useless choir. He cursed when he cut into his thumb, and only then did he notice Nadia standing nervously by his chair.
Papa, Nadia said, please, do not marry Karina.
She hoped that he would deny that he had been contemplating such a thing. Instead, he sucked his wounded thumb and said,
why not? Don't you like Karina?
No, said Nadia, honestly.
And she doesn't like me. Maxim laughed and ran his rough knuckles over her cheek.
Sweet Nadia, who could not love you?
Papa.
Karina is a good woman,
Maxim said. His knuckles brushed her cheek again.
It would be better if...
Abruptly, he dropped his hand and turned his face back to the fire. His eyes were distant, and when he spoke, his voice was cold and strange, as if rising from the bottom of a well.
Karina is a good woman,
he repeated. His fingers gripped the arms of his chair.
Now, leave me be.
She has him already, thought Nadia.
He is under her spell. The night before Havel left for the south, a dance was held in the barn by the Panken farm. In better years, it might have been a raucous night, the tables piled high with plates of nuts and apples, pots of honey and jars of peppery kvass. The men still drank and the fiddle played, but even pine boughs and the high shine of Baba Olya's treasured samovar could not hide the fact that now the tables were empty. And though people stomped and clapped their hands, they could not chase away the gloom that seemed to hang over the room. Janechka Lukin was chosen Dros Korolyeva, Queen of the Thaw, and made to dance with all who asked her, in the hope that it would bring about a short winter. But only Havel looked truly happy. He was off to the army, to carry a gun and eat hot meals from the king's pocket. He might die, or come back wounded, as so many had before him. But on this night, his face glowed with the relief of leaving Duva behind. Nadia danced once with her brother, once with Viktor Yoronov, then took a seat with the widows and wives and children. Her eyes fell on Karina, standing close to her father. Her limbs were white birch branches. Her eyes were ice over black water. Maxim looked unsteady on his feet.
Kitka, The word drifted down to Nadia from the barn's shadowed eaves. As she watched Karina weave her arm through Maxim's like the pale stalk of a climbing vine, Nadia pushed her foolish thoughts away and turned to watch Janechka Lukin dance, her long golden hair braided with bright red ribbons. Nadia was ashamed to feel a pang of envy. Silly, she told herself, watching Janechka struggle through a dance with Anton Kozar. He simply stood and swayed, one arm keeping balance on his crutch, the other clutching tightly to poor Janechka's waist. Silly, but she felt it just the same.
Go with Havel, said a voice at her shoulder.
Nadia nearly jumped. She hadn't noticed Karina standing beside her. She looked up at the slender woman, her dark hair lying in coils around her white neck. Nadia turned her gaze back to the dance. I can't, and you know it. I'm not old enough. It would be 2 more years before she was called to the draft.
So lie.
This is my home, Nadia whispered furiously, embarrassed by the tears that rose behind her eyes. You can't just send me away. My father won't let you, she added silently, but somehow she did not have the courage to speak the words aloud. Karina leaned in close to Nadia. When she smiled, her lips split wet and red around what seemed like far too many teeth.
Havel could at least work and hunt, she whispered. You're just another mouth.
She reached out and tugged one of Nadia's curls hard. Nadia knew that if her father happened to look over, he would just see a beautiful woman grinning and talking to his daughter, perhaps encouraging her to dance.
I will warn you just this once, hissed Karina Stoyanova. Go.
The next day, Janechka Lukin's mother discovered that her daughter's bed had not been slept in. The Queen of the Thaw had never made it home from the dance. At the edge of the wood, a red ribbon fluttered from the branches of a narrow birch, a few golden hairs trailing from the knot, as if it had been torn from her head. Nadia stood silent as Janechka's mother fell to her knees and began to wail, calling out to her saints and pressing the red ribbon to her lips as she wept. Across the road, Nadia saw Karina watching, her eyes black, her lips turned down like peeling bark, her long, slender fingers like raw spokes of branches, stripped bare by a hard wind. When Havel said his goodbyes, he drew Nadia close.
Be safe, he whispered in her ear.
How? Nadia replied, but Havel had no answer. A week later, Maxim Grushov and Karina Stoyanova were wed in a little whitewashed chapel at the center of town. There was no food for a wedding feast, and there were no flowers for the bride's hair, but she wore her grandmother's pearl kokoshnik, and all agreed that, though the pearls were most likely fake, she was lovely just the same. That night, Nadia slept in Baba Olya's front room so the bride and groom could be alone. In the morning, when she returned home, she found the house silent, the couple still abed. On the kitchen table lay an overturned bottle of wine and the remnants of what must have been a cake, the crumbs still scented with orange blossom. It seemed Karina had still had some sugar to spare, after all. Nadia couldn't help herself. She licked the plate. Despite Havel's absence, the house felt crowded now. Maxim prowled the rooms, unable to sit still for more than a few minutes. He'd seemed calm after the wedding, nearly happy. But with every passing day, he grew more restless. He drank and cursed his lack of work, his lost sledge, his empty stomach. He snapped at Nadia and turned away when she came too near, as if he could barely stand the sight of her. On the rare occasions Maxim showed Nadia any affection, Karina would appear, hovering in the doorway, her black eyes greedy, a rag twisting in her narrow hands. She would order Nadia into the kitchen and burden her with some ridiculous chore, commanding her to stay out of her father's way. At meals, Karina watched Nadia eat, as if her every bite of watered-down broth was an offense.
as if every scrape of Nadia's spoon hollowed out Karina's belly a little more, widening the hole inside her. Little more than a week had passed before Karina took hold of Nadia's arm and nodded toward the woods.
"Go check the traps," she said.
"It's almost dark," Nadia protested.
"Don't be foolish. There's plenty of light. Now go and make yourself useful and don't come back without a rabbit for our supper."
"Where's my father?" Nadia demanded.
"He is with Anton Kozar, playing cards and drinking, and trying to forget that he was cursed with a useless daughter."
Karina gave Nadia a hard push out the door.
"Go, or I'll tell him that I caught you with Viktor Yeronov."
Nadia longed to march to Anton Kozar's shabby rooms, knock the glass from her father's hands, tell him that she wanted her home back from this dangerous, dark-eyed stranger. And if she'd been sure that her father would take her side, she might have done just that. Instead, Nadia walked into the woods. When the first two snares were empty, she ignored her pounding heart and the lengthening shadows and forced herself to walk on, following the white stones that Havel had used to mark the path. In the third trap, she found a brown hare trembling with fright. She ignored the panicked whistle from its lungs as she snapped its neck with a single determined twist and felt its warm body go limp. As she walked home with her prize, she let herself imagine her father's pleasure at the evening meal. He would tell her she was brave and foolish to go into the wood alone. And when she told him that his new wife had insisted, he would send Karina from their home forever. But when she stepped inside the house, Karina was waiting, her face pale with fury. She seized Nadia, tore the rabbit from her hands, and shoved her into her room. Nadia heard the bolt slide home. For a long while she pounded at the door, shouting to be let free. But who was there to hear her? Finally, weak with hunger and frustration, she let her tears come. She curled on her bed, shaken by sobs, kept awake by the hollow growling of her gut. She missed Havel. She missed her mother. All she'd had to eat was a piece of turnip at breakfast, and she knew that if Karina hadn't taken the hare from her, she would have torn it open and eaten it raw. Later, she heard the door to the house bang open, heard her father's unsteady footsteps coming down the hall, the tentative scratch of his fingers at her door. Before she could answer, she heard Karina's voice, crooning, crooning. Silence, the rustle of fabric, a thump, followed by a groan, then the steady thud of bodies against the wall. Nadia clutched her pillow to her ears, trying to drown out their pants and moans, sure that Karina knew she could hear, and that this was some kind of punishment. She buried her head beneath the covers, but could not escape that shaming, frantic rhythm, keeping time to the echo of Karina's voice that night at the dance.
"I will warn you just this once. Go, go, go."
The next day, Nadia's father did not rise until afternoon. When he entered the kitchen and Nadia handed him his tea, he flinched away from her, eyes skittering across the floor. Karina stood at the basin, face pinched, mixing up a batch of lye.
"I'm going to Anton's," Maxim said.
Nadia wanted to beg him not to leave her, but even in her own head, the plea sounded foolish. In the next moment, he was gone. This time, when Karina took hold of her and said,
"Go check the traps,"
Nadia did not argue. She had braved the woods once, and she would do it again. This time, she would clean and cook the rabbit herself and return home with a full belly, strong enough to face Karina with or without her father's help. Hope made her stubborn. When the first flurries of snow fell, Nadia pushed on, moving from one empty trap to the next. It was only when the light began to fade that she realized she could no longer make out Havel's white stone markers. Nadia stood in the falling snow and turned in a slow circle, searching for some familiar sign that would lead her back to the path. The trees were black slashes of shadow. The ground rose and fell in soft, billowing drifts. The light had gone dull and diffuse. There was no way of knowing which way home might be. All around her there was silence, broken only by the howl of the rising wind, and her own rough breathing as the woods slid into darkness. And then she smelled it, hot and sweet, a fragrant cloud that singed the edges of her nostrils, burning sugar. Nadia's breath came in frantic little gasps, and even as her terror grew, her mouth began to water. She thought of the rabbit, plucked from the trap, the rapid beat of its heart, the rolling whites of its eyes. Something brushed against her in the dark. Nadia did not pause to think. She ran. She crashed blindly through the wood, branches lashing at her cheeks, her feet tangling in snow-laden brambles. Unsure if she heard her own clumsy footfalls or something slavering behind her, something with crowded teeth and long white fingers that clutched at the hem of her coat. When she glimpsed the glow of light filtering through the trees ahead, for one delirious moment she thought she'd somehow made it home. But as she burst into the clearing, she saw that the hut silhouetted before her was all wrong. It was lean and crooked, with lights that glowed in every window. No one in her village would ever waste candles that way. The hut seemed to shift, almost as if it were turning to welcome her. She hesitated, took a step back. A twig snapped behind her. She bolted for the hut's painted door. Nadia rattled the handle, sending the lantern above swaying. "Help me!" she cried, and the door swung open. She slipped inside, slamming it behind her. Was that a thump she heard? The frustrated scrabble of paws? It was hard to tell over the hoarse sobs wheezing from her chest. She stood with her forehead pressed to the door, waiting for her heart to stop hammering, and only then, when she could take a full breath, did she turn. The room was warm and golden, like the inside of a currant bun, thick with the smells of browning meat and fresh-baked bread. Every surface gleamed like new, cheerfully painted with leaves and flowers, animals and tiny people, the paint so fresh and bright it hurt her eyes to look at it after the dull gray surfaces of duva. At the far wall, a woman stood at a vast black cook stove that stretched the length of the room. 20 different pots boiled atop it, some small and covered, some large and near to bubbling over. The oven beneath had 2 hinged iron doors that opened from the center and was so large that a man might have lain lengthwise in it, or at least a child. The woman lifted the lid of one of the pots, and a cloud of fragrant steam drifted toward Nadia. Onions, sorrel, chicken stock. Hunger came upon her, more piercing and consuming than her fear. A low growl escaped her lips, and she clapped a hand to her mouth. The woman glanced over her shoulder. She was old but not ugly, her long gray braid tied with a red ribbon. Nadia stared at that ribbon and hesitated, thinking of Janetchka Lukin. The smells of sugar and lamb and garlic and butter all layered upon one another made her shake with longing. A dog lay curled in a basket, gnawing on a bone. But when Nadia looked closer, she saw it was not a dog at all, but a little bear wearing a golden collar.
"You like Vladchek?"
Nadia nodded. The woman set a heaping plate of stew down on the table.
"Sit," said the woman as she returned to the stove. "Eat."
Nadia removed her coat and hung it by the door. She pulled her damp mittens from her hands and sat down carefully at the table. She lifted her spoon, but still she hesitated. She knew from stories that you must not eat at a witch's table. But in the end, she could not resist. She ate the stew, every hot and savory bite of it, then flaky rolls, plums in syrup, egg pudding, and a rum cake thick with raisins and brown sugar. Nadia ate and ate, while the woman tended to the pots on the stove, sometimes humming a little as she worked.
"She's fattening me up,"
thought Nadia, her eyelids growing heavy.
She'll wait for me to fall asleep, and stuff me in the oven and cook me up to make more stew. But Nadia found she didn't care.
The woman set a blanket by the stove, next to Vladchek's basket, and Nadia fell off to sleep, glad that at least she would die with a full belly. But when she woke the next morning, she was still in one piece, and the table was set with a hot bowl of porridge, stacks of rye toast slathered with butter, and plates of shiny little herring swimming in oil. The old woman introduced herself as Magda, then sat silent, sucking on a sugared plum, watching Nadia eat her breakfast. Nadia ate till her stomach ached, while outside the snow continued to fall. When she was done, she set her empty bowl down on the floor, where Vladchek licked it clean. Only then did Magda spit the plum pit into her palm and say,
"What is it you want?"
"I want to go home," Nadia replied.
"So go."
Nadia looked outside to where the snow was still falling. "I can't."
"Well then," said Magda, "come help me stir the pot."
For the rest of the day, Nadia darned socks, scrubbed pans, chopped herbs, and strained syrups. She stood at the stove for long hours, her hair curling from the heat and steam, stirring many little pots, and wondering all the while what might become of her. That night, they ate stuffed cabbage leaves, crispy roast goose, little dishes of apricot custard. The next day, Nadia breakfasted on butter-soaked blini stuffed with cherries and cream. When she finished, the witch asked her,
"What is it you want?"
"I want to go home," said Nadia, glancing at the snow still falling outside. "But I can't."
"Well then," said Magda, "come help me stir the pot."
This was how it went, day after day, as the snow fell and filled the clearing, rising up around the hut in great white waves. On the morning the snow finally stopped, the witch fed Nadia potato pie and sausages and asked her,
"What is it you want?"
"I want to go home," said Nadia.
"Well then," said Magda, "you'd better start shoveling."
So Nadia took up the shovel and cleared a path around the hut, accompanied by Vladchek snuffling in the snow beside her, and an eyeless crow that Magda fed on rye crumbs and that sometimes perched upon the witch's shoulder. In the afternoon, Nadia ate a slab of black bread spread with soft cheese and a dish of baked apples. Magda gave her a mug of hot tea laced with sugar, and back out she went. When she finally reached the edge of the clearing, she wondered just where she was supposed to go. The frost had come. The woods were a frozen mass of snow and tangled branches. What might be waiting for her in there? And even if she could make it through the deep snow and find her way back to Duva, what then? A tentative embrace from her weak-willed father? Far worse, from his hungry-eyed wife? No path could lead her back to the home she had known. The thought opened a bleak crack inside of her, a fissure where the cold seeped through. For a terrifying moment, she was nothing but a lost girl, nameless and unwanted. She might stand there forever, a shovel in her hand, with no one to call her home. Nadia turned on her heel and scurried back to the warm confines of the hut, whispering her own name beneath her breath as if she might forget it. Each day Nadia worked. She cleaned floors, dusted shelves, mended clothes, shoveled snow, and scraped the ice away from the windows. But mostly she helped Magda with her cooking. It was not all food. There were tonics and ointments, bitter-smelling pastes, jewel-colored powders packed in small enamel boxes, tinctures, and brown glass bottles. There was always something strange brewing on that stove. Soon, she learned why. They came late at night, when the moon was waxing, slogging through miles of ice and snow, men and women on sledges and shaggy ponies, even on foot. They brought eggs, jars of preserves, sacks of flour, bales of wheat,
They brought smoked fish, blocks of salt, wheels of cheese, bottles of wine, tins of tea, and bag after bag of sugar, for there was no denying Magda's sweet tooth. They cried out for love potions and untraceable poisons. They begged to be made beautiful, healthy, rich. Always, Nadia stayed hidden. On Magda's orders, she climbed high into the shelves of the larder.
"Stay there, and keep quiet," Magda said. "I don't need rumors starting that I've been taking girls."
So Nadia sat with Vladchek, nibbling on a spice cookie or sucking on a hunk of black licorice, watching Magda work. She might have announced herself to these strangers at any time, pleaded to be taken home or given shelter, shouted that she'd been trapped by a witch. Instead, she stayed silent, sugar melting on her tongue, watching as they came to this old woman, how they turned to her with desperation, with resentment, but always with respect. Magda gave them drops for the eyes, tonics for the scalp. She ran her hands over their wrinkles, tapped a man's chest till he hacked up black bile. Nadia was never sure how much was real and how much was show, until the night the wax-skinned woman came. She was gaunt, as they all were, her face a skull of hard-carved hollows. Magda asked the question she asked anyone who came to her door.
"What is it you want?"
The woman collapsed in her arms, weeping. As Magda murmured soothing words, patted her hand, dried her tears. They conferred in voices too low for Nadia to decipher, and before the woman left, she took a tiny pouch from her pocket and shook the contents into Magda's palm. Nadia craned her neck to get a better look, but Magda's hand clamped shut too quickly. The next day, Magda sent Nadia out of the house to shovel snow. When she returned at lunchtime, she was shooed back out with a cup of codfish stew. Dusk came, and as Nadia finished sprinkling salt along the edges of the path, the scent of gingerbread drifted to her across the clearing, rich and spicy, filling her nose until she felt nearly drunk. All through dinner she waited for Magda to open the oven, but when the meal was finished, the old woman set a piece of yesterday's lemon cake before her. Nadia shrugged. As she reached for the cream, she heard a soft sound, a gurgle. She looked at Vladchek, but the bear was fast asleep, snoring softly. And then she heard it again, a gurgle followed by a plaintive coo from inside the oven. Nadia pushed back from the table, nearly knocking her chair over, and stared at Magda, horrified. But the witch did not flinch. A knock sounded at the door.
"Go into the larder, Nadia."
For a moment, Nadia hovered between the table and the door, caught like a fly that might still free itself from the web. Then she backed into the larder, pausing only to grab hold of Vladchek's collar and drag him with her onto the top shelf, comforted by his drowsy snuffling and the warm feel of his fur beneath her hands. Magda opened the door. The wax-faced woman stood waiting at the threshold, almost as if she were afraid to move. Magda wrapped her hands in towels and pulled open the oven's iron doors. A squalling cry filled the room. The woman grabbed at the doorposts as her knees buckled, then pressed her hands to her mouth, her chest heaving, tears streaming over her sallow cheeks. Magda swaddled the ginger baby in a red kerchief and handed it, squirming and mewling, into the woman's trembling, outstretched arms.
"Milaya,"
the woman crooned. "Sweet girl." She turned her back on Magda and disappeared into the night, not bothering to close the door behind her. The next day, Nadia left her breakfast untouched, placing her cold bowl of porridge on the floor for Vladchek. He turned up his nose at it until Magda put it back on the stove to warm. Before Magda could ask her question, Nadia said, "That wasn't a real child. Why did she take it?"
"It was real enough."
"What will happen to it? What will happen to her?" Nadia asked, a wild edge to her voice.
"Eventually it will become nothing but crumbs,"
said Magda.
And then what? Will you just make her another?
The mother will be dead long before that. She has the same fever that took her infant.
Then cure her!
Nadia shouted, smacking the table with her unused spoon.
She didn't ask to be cured. She asked for a child.
Nadia put on her mittens and stomped out into the yard. She did not go inside for lunch. She meant to skip dinner, too, to show what she thought of Magda and her terrible magic. But by the time night came, her stomach was growling, and when Magda put down a plate of sliced duck with hunter's sauce, Nadia picked up her fork and knife.
I want to go home,
she muttered to her plate.
So, go, said Magda.
Winter dragged on with frost and cold, but the lamps always burned golden in the little hut. Nadia's cheeks grew rosy and her clothes grew snug. She learned how to mix up Magda's tonics without looking at the recipes, and how to bake an almond cake in the shape of a crown. She learned which herbs were valuable and which were dangerous, and which herbs were valuable because they were dangerous. Nadia knew there was much that Magda didn't teach her. She told herself she was glad of it, that she wanted nothing to do with Magda's abominations. But sometimes she felt her curiosity clawing at her like a different kind of hunger. And then, one morning, she woke to the tapping of the blind crow's beak on the sill, and the drip, drip, drip of melted snow from the eaves. Bright sun shone through the windows. The thaw had come. That morning, Magda laid out sweet rolls with prune jam, a plate of boiled eggs, and bitter greens. Nadia ate and ate, afraid to reach the end of her meal. But eventually she could not take another bite.
What is it you want?
Asked Magda. This time Nadia hesitated, afraid.
If I go, couldn't I just...
You cannot come and go from this place like you're fetching water from a well. I will not have you bring a monster to my door.
Nadia shivered. A monster. So she'd been right about Corina.
What is it you want?
Asked Magda again. Nadia thought of Janechka dancing, of nervous Lara, of Betsya and Ludmila, of the others she had never known. I want my father to be free of Corina. I want Duva to be safe. I want to go home. Gently, Magda reached out and touched Nadia's left hand. First the ring finger, then the pinky. Nadia thought of the wax-faced woman, of the little bag she'd emptied into the witch's palm.
Think on it, said Magda.
The next morning, when Magda went to lay out the breakfast, she found the cleaver Nadia had placed there. For 2 days, the cleaver lay untouched on the table, as they measured and sifted and mixed, making batch after batch of batter. On the second afternoon, when the hardest of the work was done, Magda turned to Nadia.
You know that you are welcome to remain here with me, said the witch.
Nadia stretched out her hand. Magda sighed. The cleaver flashed once in the afternoon sun, the edge gleaming the dull gray of Grisha steel, then fell with a sound like a gunshot. At the sight of her fingers lying forlorn on the table, Nadia fainted. Magda healed the stumps of Nadia's fingers, bound her hand, let her rest, and while she slept, Magda took the two fingers and ground them down to a wet, red meal that she mixed into the batter. When Nadia revived, they worked side by side, shaping the ginger girl on a damp plank, as big as a door, then shoved her into the blazing oven. All night the ginger girl baked, filling the hut with a marvelous smell. Nadia knew she was smelling her own bones and blood, but still her mouth watered. She dozed. Near dawn the oven doors creaked open, and the ginger girl crawled out. She crossed the room, opened the window, and lay down on the counter to let herself cool. In the morning, Nadia and Magda attended the ginger girl, dusted her with sugar,
gave her frosted lips and thick ropes of icing for hair. Finally, they dressed her in Nadia's clothes and boots and set her on the path toward Duva. They ate a small meal of herring and soft eggs to keep up their strength. Then Magda sat Nadia down at the table and took a small jar from one of the cabinets. She opened the window, and the eyeless black crow came to rest on the table, picking at the crumbs the ginger girl had left behind. Magda tipped the contents of the jar into her palm and held them out to Nadia. "Open your mouth," she said. In Magda's hand, floating in a pool of shiny fluid, lay a pair of bright blue eyes. Hatchling's eyes.
"Do not swallow," said Magda sternly. "And do not retch."
Nadia closed her eyes and forced her lips to part. She tried not to gag as the crow's eyes slid onto her tongue.
"Open your eyes," commanded Magda.
Nadia obeyed, and when she did, the whole room had shifted. She saw herself sitting in a chair, eyes still closed, Magda beside her. She tried to raise her hands but found that her wings rose instead. She hopped on her little crow feet and released a startled squawk of surprise. Magda shooed her to the window, and Nadia, elated from the feeling of her wings and the wind spreading beneath them, did not see the sadness in the old woman's gaze. Nadia rose high into the air, in a great wheeling arc, dipping her wings, learning the feel of them, slicing through the long shadows of the dwindling afternoon. She saw the woods spread beneath her, the clearing and Magda's hut. She saw the jagged peaks of the Petrozoi in the distance, and gliding lower she saw the ginger girl's path through the woods. She swooped and darted between the trees, unafraid of the forest for the first time since she could remember. She circled over Duva, saw the main street, the cemetery, two new altars laid out. Two more girls gone during the long winter while she grew fat at the witch's table. They would be the last. She screeched and dove beside the ginger girl, driving her onward, her soldier, her champion. Nadia watched from a clothesline as the ginger girl crossed the clearing to her father's house. Inside, she could hear raised voices arguing. Did he know what Karina had done? Had he begun to suspect what she truly was? The ginger girl knocked, and the voices quieted. When the door swung open, her father squinted into the dusk. Nadia was shocked at the toll the winter had taken on him. His broad shoulders looked hunched and narrow, and even from a distance she could see the way the skin hung loose on his frame. She waited for him to cry out in horror at the monster that stood before him.
"Nadia?"
Maxim gasped.
"Nadia!"
He pulled the ginger girl into his arms with a rough cry. Karina appeared behind him in the door, face pale, eyes wide. Nadia felt a twinge of disappointment. Somehow she'd imagined that Karina would take one look at the ginger girl and crumble to dust, or that the sight of Nadia alive and well on her doorstep would force her to blurt out some ugly confession. Maxim drew the ginger girl inside, and Nadia fluttered down to the windowsill to peer through the glass. The house looked more cramped and gray than ever after the warmth of Magda's hut. She saw that the collection of wooden dolls on the mantel had grown. Nadia's father caressed the ginger girl's burnished brown arm, peppering her with questions. But the ginger girl stayed silent, huddling by the fire. Nadia wasn't even sure that she could speak. Maxim did not seem to notice her silence. He babbled on, laughing, crying, shaking his head in wonder. Karina hovered behind him, watching as she always had. There was fear in her eyes, but something else, too. Something troubling that looked almost like gratitude. Then Karina stepped forward, touched the ginger girl's soft cheek, her frosted hair. Nadia waited, sure Karina would be singed, that she would let out a shriek as the flesh of her hand peeled away like bark, revealing not bones but branches and the monstrous form of the Kitka beneath her pretty skin. Instead, Corina bowed her head and murmured what might have been a prayer. She took her coat from the hook.
I am going to Baba Olya's.
Yes, yes,
Maxim said distractedly, unable to pull his gaze from his daughter.
She's running away,
Nadia realized in horror, and the ginger girl was making no move to stop her. Corina wrapped her head in a scarf, pulled on her gloves, and slipped out the door, shutting it behind her without a backward glance. Nadia hopped and squawked from the window ledge.
I will follow her, she thought. I will peck out her eyes.
Corina bent down, picked up a pebble from the path, and hurled it at Nadia. Nadia released an indignant caw. But when Corina spoke, her voice was gentle.
Fly away now, little bird, she said. Some things are better left unseen.
Then she disappeared into the dusk. Nadia fluttered her wings, unsure of what to do. She peered back through the window. Her father had pulled the ginger girl into his lap and was stroking her white hair.
Nadia,
he said again and again.
Nadia.
He nuzzled the brown flesh of her shoulder, pressed his lips to her skin. Outside, Nadia's small heart beat against her hollow bones.
Forgive me,
Maxim murmured, the tears on his cheeks dissolving the soft curve of icing at her neck. Nadia shivered. Her wings stuttered a futile, desperate tattoo on the glass, but her father's hand slipped beneath the hem of her skirts, and the ginger girl did not move.
It isn't me, Nadia told herself. Not really. It isn't me.
She thought of her father's restlessness, of his lost horses, his treasured sledge. Before that, girls had gone missing from other towns, one here, one there. Stories, rumors, faraway crimes. But then the famine had come, the long winter, and Maxim had been trapped, forced to hunt closer to home.
I've tried to stop, he said as he pulled his daughter close. Believe me, he begged. Say you believe me.
The ginger girl stayed silent. Maxim opened his wet mouth to kiss her again, and the sound he made was something between a groan and a sigh as his teeth sank into the sweetness of her shoulder. The sigh turned to a sob as he bit down. Nadia watched her father consume the ginger girl, bite by bite, limb by limb. He wept as he ate, but he did not stop, and by the time he was finished, the fire was cold in the grate. When he was done, he lay stretched out on the floor, his belly distended, his fingers sticky, his beard crusted with crumbs. Only then did the crow turn away. They found Nadia's father there the next morning, his insides ruptured and stinking of rot. He had spent the night on his knees, vomiting blood and sugar. Corina had not been home to help him. When they took up the blood-stained floorboards, they found a stash of objects. Among them, a child's prayer book, a bracelet of glass beads, the rest of the vivid red ribbons Janetchka had worn in her hair the night of the dance, and Lara Denikin's white apron, embroidered with her clumsy stitches, the strings stained with blood. From the mantel, the little wooden dolls looked on. Nadia flew back to the witch's hut, returned to her body by Magda's soft words and Vladchek licking her limp hand. She spent long days in silence, working beside Magda, only picking at her food. It was not her father she thought of, but Corina. Corina, who had found ways to visit their home when Nadia's mother took ill, who had filled the rooms when Havel left, keeping Nadia close. Corina, who had driven Nadia into the woods so that there would be nothing left for her father to use but a ghost. Corina, who had given herself to a monster in the hope of saving just one girl. Nadia scrubbed and cooked and cleared the garden and thought of Corina alone with Maxim,
over the long winter, fearing his absences, longing for them, searching the house for some way to prove her suspicions, her fingers scrabbling over floors and cabinets, feeling for the secret seams hidden by the carpenter's clever hands. In Duva, there was talk of burning Maxim Grushov's body, but in the end, they buried him without saints' prayers, in rocky soil, where to this day nothing grows. The lost girls' bodies were never found, though occasionally a hunter will come across a stash of bones in the woods, a shell comb, or a shoe. Karina moved away to another little town. Who knows what became of her? Few good things happen to a woman alone. Nadia's brother, Havel, served in the northern campaign and came home quite the hero. As for Nadia, she lived with Magda and learned all the old woman's tricks, magic best not spoken of on a night like this. There are some who say that when the moon is waxing, she dares things not even Magda would try. Now you know what monsters once lurked in the woods near Duva, and if you ever meet a bear with a golden collar, you will be able to greet him by name. So shut the window tight, and make sure the latch is fastened. Dark things have a way of slipping in through narrow spaces. Shall we have something good to eat? Well then, come help me stir the pot. Little Knife. It is dangerous to travel the northern road with a troubled heart. Just south of Arkesk is a break in the trees, a place where no bird sings, and the shadows hang from the branches with strange weight. On this lonely mile, travelers stay close to their companions. They sing loud songs and beat the drum, for if you are lost to your own thoughts, you may find yourself stepping off the path and into the dark woods. And if you continue, ignoring the shouts of your companions, your feet may carry you to the silent streets and abandoned houses of Velisiana, the cursed city. Weeds and wildflowers crowd the cobblestones. The shops are empty, and the doors have rotted on their hinges, leaving only gaping mouths. The town square is overgrown with brambles, and the church roof has long since given way. Amid the shattered pews, the great dome lies on its side, collecting rainwater, its gold leaf stripped away by time, or some enterprising thief. You may recognize this quiet as you stand in what was once Suitor's Square, staring up at the grand facade of a crumbling palace, and the little window high above the street, its casement carved with lilies. This is the sound of a heart gone silent. Velisiana is a corpse. In days past, the town was known for two things, the quality of its flour, used by every kitchen for nearly 100 miles, and the beauty of Yeva Luchova, the old duke's daughter. The duke was not a particular favorite of the king, but he'd grown rich anyway. He'd installed dams and dikes to contain the river, so that it no longer flooded his lands, and he'd built the great mill, where Velisiana's flour was ground, commissioning a giant water wheel with sturdy steel spokes, perfect in its balance. There is some debate over what Yeva Luchova actually looked like, whether her hair was burnished gold or lustrous black, whether her eyes were blue as sapphires or green as new grass. It is not the particulars of her beauty, but the power of it that concerns us, and we need only know that Yeva was lovely from the moment of her birth. She was so beautiful, in fact, that the midwife attending her mother snatched up the wailing infant and locked herself in a linen closet, begging for just another moment to gaze upon Yeva's face, and refusing to relinquish the baby until the duke called for an axe to break down the door. The duke had the midwife whipped, but that didn't stop several of Yeva's nursemaids from trying to steal the child away. Finally, her father hired a blind old woman to care for his daughter, and there was peace in his home. Of course, that peace did not last, for Yeva only grew more beautiful as she aged. No one could make sense of it, for neither the duke nor his wife were much to look at. There were rumors that Yeva's mother had found her way into the camp of a Suli traveler,
and more jealous sorts like to whisper that a handsome demon had crept in with the moonlight and tricked his way into her mother's bed. Most of the townspeople laughed away these stories, for no one could know Yeva's kindness and think that she was anything but a good and righteous girl. And yet, when Yeva walked down the street, the wind lifting her hair, her lovely feet barely seeming to touch the cobblestones, it was hard not to wonder. Every year on Yeva's birthday, under the guise of placing flowers in her braids, the blind nursemaid would check Yeva's scalp, feeling with trembling fingers for the bumps of new horns. As Yeva's beauty grew, so did her father's pride. When she turned 12, he had a portrait artist come all the way from Ols Alta to paint her surrounded by lilies, and had her image stamped on every bag of flour from his mill. So women in their kitchens came to wear their hair like Yeva, and men from all over Ravka traveled to Velisiana to see if such a creature could be real. Of course, the artist fell in love with Yeva, too. He put dropwort in her milk, and got all the way to Arkesk with her before he was apprehended. The Duke found his daughter sleeping soundly in the back of the pony cart, wedged between canvases and jars of pigments. Yeva was quite unharmed, and had little memory of the event, though she forever had an aversion to portrait galleries, and the smell of oil paint would always make her drowsy. By the time Yeva was 15, it was no longer safe for her to leave the house. She tried cutting her hair and covering her face in ashes, but this only made her more intriguing to the men who spied her on her daily walk, for when they saw her, their imaginations ran wild. When Yeva stopped to remove a stone from her shoe and unwittingly gave the crowd a glimpse of her perfect ankle, a riot broke out, and her father decided she must be confined to the palace. She spent her days reading and sewing, walking back and forth through the halls for exercise, always in a veil so as not to distract the servants. Every day when the clock on the bell tower chimed the noon hour, she appeared at her window to wave at the people gathered in the square below, and to let her suitors come forward to declare their love and beg for her hand. They would sing songs or perform tricks or stage duels to prove their daring. Though the duels sometimes got out of hand, and after the second death, the retired army colonel who acted as constable had to put a stop to them. "Papa," Yeva said to the Duke, desperate to stand beneath an open sky again, "why must I be the one to hide?" The Duke patted her hand.
"Enjoy this power, Yeva. For one day you will grow old and no one will notice when you walk down the street."
Yeva did not think her father had answered her question, but she kissed his cheek and returned to her sewing. On the morning of her 16th birthday, Nestor Levkin appeared at the door with his son. He was one of the wealthiest men of the town, second only to the Duke, and had come to barter for a union between Yeva and his boy. But as soon as he stepped into the parlor and saw Yeva sitting by the fire, he declared that he would be the one to marry her. Father and son took to arguing and then went at each other with their fists. The retired colonel was called upon to settle the dispute, but at his first real glimpse of Yeva, he drew his sword and challenged both of her other suitors. Yeva's father sent her to her room and called for guards to pull the men apart. In time, free from the spell of Yeva's beauty, the men returned to their senses. They drank tea together and lowered their heads in shame at their behavior.
"You cannot let this go on," said the colonel. "Every day the crowd in the square grows. You must choose a husband for Yeva and be done with this madness before the town is torn apart."
Now the Duke might have put an end to all of this by simply asking his daughter what she desired, but he enjoyed the attention Yeva received, and it certainly sold a lot of flour. So he devised a plan that suited his greed and his love for spectacle. It happened that the Duke had many acres of forest that he wished to clear in order to plant more wheat. At noon the next day, he stepped out on the balcony that overlooked Suitor's Square and waved to the men below. The crowd sighed in disappointment when they saw the Duke instead of Yeva, but their ears perked up when they heard what he had to say.
It is time for my daughter to marry.
A cheer went up from the crowd.
But only a worthy man may have her. Ieva is delicate and must be kept warm. Each of you will go into my wood and bring a pile of lumber to the fallow field at the southernmost edge of the forest. At sunrise tomorrow, whoever has the tallest pile will win Ieva as his bride.
The suitors did not stop to contemplate the strangeness of this task, but bolted off to fetch their axes. As the Duke shut the balcony doors, Ieva said,
Papa, forgive me, but what way is this to choose a husband? Tomorrow I will certainly have a lot of firewood, but will I have a good man?
The Duke patted her hand.
Darling Ieva, he said, do you think I am so foolish or so cruel? Did you not see the prince standing in the square this past week, waiting patiently each day for a glimpse of you? He has gold enough to hire 1,000 men to wield their axes for him. He will win this contest easily, and you will live in the capital and wear only silk for the rest of your days. What do you think of that?
Ieva doubted that her father had answered her question, but she kissed his cheek and told him that he was very wise indeed. What neither Ieva nor her father knew was that deep in the shadows of the clock tower, Semyon the Ragged was listening. Semyon was a tide maker, and though he was powerful, he was poor. This was in the days before the Second Army, when Grisha were welcome in few places and greeted with suspicion everywhere. Semyon made his living traveling from town to town, diverting rivers when there were droughts, keeping rains at bay when the winter storms came too soon, or finding the right places to sink wells. It was simple to Semyon.
Water only wants direction,
he would say on the rare occasion he was asked.
It wants to be told what to do.
He was usually paid in barley or trade, and as soon as he was done with the task, the villagers would ask him to move on. It was no kind of life. Semyon longed for a home and a wife. He wanted new boots and a fine coat, so that when he walked down the street, people would look on him with respect. And as soon as he saw Ieva Luchova, he wanted her too. Semyon made his way through town to the edge of the southern wood, where the suitors were already hacking away at the trees and building their piles of timber. He had no axe, and no money to buy one. He was clever, and even desperate enough to steal, but he'd seen the prince loitering beneath Ieva's window, and he thought he understood the Duke's plan well enough. His heart sank as he watched teams of men building the prince's pile, while the prince himself looked on, golden-haired and smiling, twirling an ivory-handled axe with an edge that glinted the strange dark gray of Grisha steel. Semyon went down to the river, to the sorry camp he had made, where he kept his bundle of rags and his few belongings. He sat on the banks and listened to the steady thump and splash of the water-wheel beside the great mill. Around people, Semyon was tongue-tied and sullen, but on the sloping riverbank, amid the soft rustle of reeds, he spoke freely, unburdening his heart to the water, confiding all his secret aspirations. The river laughed at his jokes, listened and murmured assent, roared in shared anger and indignation when he'd been wronged. But as the sun set, and the axes fell silent in the distance, Semyon knew the men would go home with the last of the daylight. The contest was as good as over.
What am I to do? He said to the river. Tomorrow, Ieva will have a prince for a husband, and I will still have nothing. Always you have done my bidding. But what good are you to me now?
To his surprise, the river burbled a high, sweet sound, almost like a woman singing. It splashed left, then right, breaking up against the rocks, frothing and foaming as if troubled by a storm. Semyon stumbled backward, his boots sinking in the mud as the water rose.
River, what do you do? He cried.
The river swelled in a great curling wave and rushed toward him, breaching its banks. Semyon covered his head with his arms, sure he would be drowned, but just as the water was about to strike him, The river split and raced around his shaking body. Through the woods the river tumbled, tearing ancient trees from the soil, stripping away branches.